I'm Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. In Hollywood, when someone shines a light on what happens off screen, it's not always pretty. But director Tony Zierra's documentary Film Worker reveals the best of movie making. It tells the story of the unsung hero, the film worker, whose name appears in the credits after most moviegoers have already left the theater. The focus is Leon Vitali, who at 27 turned his back on a promising acting career to serve as Stanley Kubrick's right-hand man. Vitali, a working-class kid from outside Birmingham, England, trained as an actor and got his break in Kubrick's period masterpiece, Barry Lyndon.
Mr. Redmond Barry, the last occasion on which we met, you wantonly caused me injury and dishonor in such a manner and to such an extent as to which no gentleman can willingly suffer without demanding satisfaction, however much time intervenes. I have now come to claim that satisfaction.
But after that, Vitali's name goes from the top of the credits to the bottom. Casting, costumes, and personal assistant to Mr. Kubrick, Vitali turned his life over fully to realizing the creative vision of his visionary boss. But for actors of a certain age, his brilliant turn in Barry Lyndon will always hold a special place in our hearts. So that's where I started when I moderated a discussion with Leon Vitali and film worker director Tony Zierra at the Hamptons International Film Festival.
Every actor in the world is obsessed with Barry Lyndon. We all would say lines like Leon Vitali, the snarkiest snark in the history of cinema. Mr. Redmond Barry. The indignation, the condemnation, you know? Mm-hmm. When he says to you in the duel scene, have you had satisfaction? Mm-hmm. And your response, what's the exact word you say?
I have not received satisfaction.
Not received satisfaction. I actually know friends of mine who have used that with people in bed. It's this great, voluptuous performance in this movie, Leon Vitali, and he's gone. And then as these films come out, you see his name in the credits, like, what the hell is he doing? And of course, this film offers us an explanation to that of, like, where did Leon Vitali detour into from his acting career. I would like to welcome, please, the director of the film. Please stand up, Tony Zierra. Thank you so much for coming. And please have a warm welcome for Leon Vitali. Yeah.
The doc that became Film Worker started out as something different. Zierra set out to make the definitive account of Kubrick's 13th and final movie, Eyes Wide Shut. The project was called SK-13.
Come and sit here in the middle. Now, for Tony, I want to ask what the genesis of the film was and the idea of making Leon the protagonist.
We finished filming it, and Leon was the last person that I went to film with. And really, the premise of SK-13, which we haven't started editing yet, was about really what was going on with Stanley towards the end, because Eyes Wide Shut is a bit controversial a little bit, and I wanted to see if, like, as a lot of people
controversial
said...
Controversial how?
Well, they said that he lost it towards the end. Some people said that it was Tom and Nicole destroyed the film, and some people said he really never finished editing. And people were really surprised by casting, and it just there were a lot of unanswered. So I figured in order to understand it, I needed to research Kubrick from all the way from the beginning to today and see why did he really want to make the film? Because obviously he owned the book for 30 years. And so Leon was the last one because I knew he was close to Warner Brothers and I knew he was working with the state and I didn't want anybody to shut me down. So I left Leon last. And then when I met him at his house, first I had this image of him that I thought I was just going to get there and there's going to be this nice mansion. And he's, you know, and
was he still? Were you still in the UK then? You were in LA by then.
In LA, off Venice Boulevard. Right. Yeah, and I just got there, and it was just like this amazing, lovely, and it just came out, and he's like carried all my equipment with me, and we just hit it off, and I was like, this is like film history lives in that little house by himself, And so we decided to put the SK-13 footage away and tell his story, because I think he really needs to be acknowledged and honored, because it's true. So we, but at first it's like, because every time I would talk to someone, I did a lot of, 6 years on Eyes Wide Shut and Stanley. And the name always came up in different conversations of like, if I was talking to someone about casting, they say Leon Vitali. If I talk to someone about training actors, it was Leon Vitali. If I go to the lab, it's Leon Vitali. I mean, what actor that starts as an actor becomes the assistant and he color corrected Eyes Wide Shut? So I was like, this is too good to be true. The level of the jobs and the stuff that he did. So I had to actually go back to so many people. It was, again, like, is this really for real? And I really found that I knew this much, because he's really done a lot and he's humble about it.
Now, Kubrick begins shooting Eyes Wide Shut when? He died in 99.
I think it's the autumn of 97 we actually started.
Shooting,
I think, yeah.
And the shooting goes on for how long?
Well.
Year and a half,
yeah. Yeah, and there were a couple of breaks in there. Right. But not long, yeah.
Can't do nonstop for a year and a half.
No, you can't, no.
But and then he dies in March of 99.
That's
so
correct.
He completed principal photography before he died.
Oh, yeah, and he'd completed his final cut. I mean, and he sent it to New York for Tom and Nicole and Terry Semel, who was the head of Warner Brothers at the time, and just said, this is it. I mean, all that was left, he'd chosen the music, so all that was left there was to re-record that and to fit it in. And basically, you know, just do the sort of fine modeling job on it. And you know, all the, what can you say? There's so much to do in post-production, especially when you get closer to finishing a movie for release.
Was this film particularly difficult for him?
Well, he was getting tired because towards the end, of course, he didn't really spare himself. I mean, we wouldn't get back to the house until very often 2-3 in the morning, you know, and there'd be a kind of a normal call next morning. It'd be, usual call times and what have you. You see, Stanley, we were so looking forward to doing AI next. I was sort of so exciting, thought of working in the studio, you know, and just slamming the door and focusing on just that
shots.
There, the shots, and no distractions and nothing. And I think with Eyes Wide Shut, you know, because working indoors is a totally different environment, as you know. I mean, there are no distractions. You're focusing on exactly what needs to be done. And there's no doubt about it, he preferred shooting indoors. Any difficulty about Eyes Wide Shut he had, I think, was really more story and trying to sort of work it in a way that it would mean something, you know, to people now. But pre-production took a year, and it often took that long with him.
One of the interesting things about Kubrick for me is he made films so rarely that when you saw him, he'd aged quite a bit in between films. Kubrick is round and kind of full-bodied and a thick mane of brown hair. Then you cut to 5 and 6 and 7 years later, and it's a different Kubrick, and then a different Kubrick. And he looks withered. He looks tired. You know, he looks older.
Yeah.
He wasn't a health nut, is what I'm saying.
No doubt about that. But I think just this, this ongoing, it's almost like a grind, but not in a negative way, but everything.
It's like Ahab.
Yeah, you know, exactly, yeah. Yeah,
it's
absolutely.
Obsession. And what's interesting in the film that I love about the film is that this film reveals that there's things he couldn't do or wouldn't do, and that's what fell to you to do. You know, if there's 10 things you need a director and a director who's producing and so hands-on at his own or her own films, that individual is so hands-on. If there's 10 things they're going to do, he would do 5 or 6 of them on the deepest level. Yeah. Then the other 4 of them, he relied on someone else to do, and that fell to you, to take care of the little boy and to do a myriad of jobs. Forget all the technical jobs. Forget about you as his curator of his film stock and so forth.
In the documentary Film Worker, my guest Leon Vitali describes what a taskmaster director Stanley Kubrick was.
If anything ever went wrong, he said, it is your responsibility to make sure they understand exactly what you want. That could take 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 tries to get it right.
If I felt like I wasn't getting any response or people were kind of, for want of a better phrase, dicking me around, you know, saying they're going to send something you never get sent and you got to chase them up and chase them up, he'd say, okay, Leon, tonight you get on the phone and you say to them, if they're talking like that to you, they're talking like that to me. It really felt like there was a kind of a loyalty there. So sometimes I get...
And did you, when you came on the first job with him after you did Barry Lyndon, you shot Barry Lyndon over what period? You shot that over for 9 years? I'm kidding. You shot that what years?
I was actually told I'd got the role, and I went down to Salisbury where they were shooting in the January of, God, what was it, 73? Something like that. Time has no meaning when you've worked with him, you know. 73, and I was supposed to be there for 13 days or 8 weeks, and in the end I was there until the end of July, 73. So after that, of course, it was an incredibly long cutting period and what have you. And then he rang me because I'd actually done another film job. I think we saw it there.
You went back to acting.
Frankly, I went to acting, and I thought I could use what little clout I had to con my way into
the editing room.
The editing
as you
room.
Say in the film.
Yeah.
So you were in the editing room for Frankenstein.
Yeah.
And what does he make next? After Barry Lyndon, what does he make? I should know this.
Shining.
He makes The Shining.
And he sent me that book. He sent me a book. I told him what I was doing.
I love that. So as an actor, you go make 10 films while he's thinking of his next film.
Yeah.
And then he says, oh, come with me and make my next film.
That's right.
And you start The Shining when, like 1980?
1977. I was sent out to America to look for Danny. And then he called me towards the end of that process. I mean, it took 7 months to actually, not to find him, but to make sure there wasn't anyone better than him, because I'd found him very early in the process, right. Funny enough. And so just towards the end of that process, he said, well, while you're there, go and take some interior photographs of hotels. And I started doing that. And that got, you know, that wasn't... I thought it would just be going and take a snap of a room, you know. But it wasn't. I mean, we were talking about exposures and you got to do this, got to do that. And the only thing I'd ever had was an Instamatic, you know. But it was wonderful because he sort of stepped me through it step by step. And he said, buy the Time Life series photography books. And so I did that. And so I was kind of reading those and learning. And then he was telling me. And so towards the very end, just before we came home, he rang me and he said, what are you planning on doing after you finish here? And I said, I don't know. He said, well, okay, then you're coming to London. And that was it. I mean, suddenly I'd got a job again.
Right. So there's some people who are missing from the film, in my mind, or who don't appear in the film. Either Tom or Nicole to talk about the Eyes Wide Shut experience, or members of Kubrick's family. Did you approach any of them to do the film, or you didn't bother?
I'll be honest and say that it's really hard if you watch. I mean, you just saw the film. Ryan O'Neill is there because Leon was his co-star. Lee Ermey obviously owes pretty much everything he has for Leon, and he's always working. We go into the status issue, and a lot of people are not interested in filming with you to talk about an assistant. And so obviously Ryan would do it because they were co-actors. A lot of people in Hollywood, either you're either not going to get the truth
or they didn't know what was going on the set. And big stars are like, they're wrapped up in their own world. They're really not aware of what's happening because they show up. Obviously, there's a lot of work to do. So very little they would really know what's going on with the assistant who's running around and doing a billion things
out of their, line
yeah,
of sight.
Yeah, yeah.
What and about his family?
Family is the same thing because I don't think they were going to sit with me again and say, well, you know what? Yeah, Stanley was really difficult and he tortured Leon. And I mean, you have to be objective. It's right. I did approach some. I wasn't, you know, some won't say who, but some felt that like they, you know, they'd be undermining Stanley if they appear. They knew the truth, but they just not going to sit in front of the camera and say, yes, this man done all this stuff.
So in the end, he finishes Eyes Wide Shut. He cuts Eyes Wide Shut. It's his final cut and he dies soon after that. And the controversy is about what? Not the final. Was it about protecting the final cut, or was it about how it was going to be printed? The film, the technology of that. Where you stepped in and helped to ensure what?
Well, first of all, we had this. We were in the midst of running tests with stocks, different stocks of film for printing and what have you. So we resolved
in
that
in post.
In post. We talked about it, and we were already favoring one kind of film in particular, and we'd started sort of working with it and experimenting it. So I knew that was the line we were going to be taking there, and things like all the rest of it with the foots and the Foley and the this and that, you know, all those things. I followed the same pattern as we did on Full Metal Jacket as close as we could, you know, different films and what have you. But it was just to follow a pattern. You know, I'd hate people to think that I just think, you know, wow, I came up with all these ideas and blah, blah, blah. You know, it was that Stanley sort of had a way of working and I was able to stick with it because it was so clear, you know. And it sounds crazy, but the criteria was to wipe out whatever ideas you might have had about it. Was this shot, could it be more this or more beautiful or more contrasty, and get it right. You know, just stick with what I knew he wanted and whereabouts he wanted it to be.
Here again, Tony Ziera's documentary Film Worker.
The assumption that people think, oh, somebody's an assistant for someone, you're doing layouts. Mm-hmm. You're working with labs, you're working with restoration, you're mm-hmm. Casting people, you're working with the actors.
And sometimes I'm acting.
Was that the title you were happy with, or was that you knew?
Didn't make any difference. It? You know something, when I traveled abroad and I used to have to fill in these visas, they used to say occupation, I always used to write film worker. I mean, I'm a film worker. I'm a worker. That's what I do. So assistant to me is nothing other than I am assisting somebody to fulfill what it is they want to get up on a screen. I was dialogue coaching and casting.
But seeing what you do to kind of barnacle yourself to that ship to work with someone like that, I'm for one, look at this film, and I was just in tears when I watched this film the first time on my computer, because it was like, God, it was worth it. You said the goal was to get it right. Do you think you guys got it right with the movies that you made? The answer is yes.
Yes.
You got it right.
That's Leon Vitale and the man who made a movie about him, Tony Ziera. The documentary is called Film Worker. Another director with a reputation for respecting the men and women behind the scenes is Chris Columbus, maker of many of America's favorite family films, from Adventures in Babysitting to Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone. That respect has deep roots.
My future was basically working at either my father's aluminum factory or my mother's automotive factory. And the only escape, really, were movies back then. And I would watch whatever film came into town over and over. And I remember something clicked when I saw Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
Hear the rest of my conversation with Chris Columbus at hearsthething.org. Coming up, more of my conversation with Stanley Kubrick's assistant, Leon Vitale, on the lack of women in many of his films.
I'm Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. In his new movie, Filmworker, Tony Ziehera has documented the whole messy process of making a Kubrick film. A man as obsessed as Stanley with controlling the shot might not have been pleased. Even though Ziehera's documentary Filmworker is an inspiring story, there's one thing I and others have noticed about Kubrick's oeuvre.
One thing I want to ask both of your opinion of, which is, of course, there are almost no women in Kubrick's films. And women, you look at Lolita, obviously, one is a young sexual object tormenting him, and the other is his kind of silly, her silly mother that has to be dealt with a certain way. And from Paths of Glory on, you know, you've got some flight attendants as they're taking the space shuttle up to the, in 2001. You don't have a lot of women in featured roles. Then you get to Nicole, obviously, and the big featured role in Eyes Wide Shut. What do you think that was about with him?
Actually, you know, researching and talking to Leon, he said the greatest thing to me, which is he said that Lolita, she was the hero at the end. She's the one that walked away and got it all figured out. And you could elaborate on that afterwards. But even in Paths of Glory, the last scene with Christiana, Kubrick's wife, I think when the women came in, they were there for a very strong message, and they kind of turned things around. You could see, obviously, in Eyes Wide Shut. But I think Leon really had he could really talk about that a lot better than me, really.
What do you think? Do you have any movies on the drawing board that were from a woman's point of view ever, or no?
No, I wouldn't say I don't think he ever thought about making a movie about, you know, a man or a woman or a man's world or a woman's world or whatever. I mean, it was always a story first that caught him. And then very often, sadly, you know, the protagonists in most literature up until recently it's all been male, basically, you know. But this is what I've always said. You know, if you do look at Lolita and you do think about what that poor girl went through, and even, you know, she wasn't in great harmony with her mother either, but she came through it all. She got through it all. She was pretty tough at the end of it, if you look at it and you think about it. And she walked out, for want of a better word, a winner. He died in prison, you know. You know, Sellers' characters, one was shot and the other she escaped from too. In The Shining, who survives? I mean, Shelley Duvall, she survived with her little boy. And so I think when you think about Barry Lyndon, you know, who survived and kept, you know, even though he tried his best to destroy it, she actually kept her standing and her, you know, her, what can you call it, her position in life, her status and what have you. So, you know, I don't think he thought about it in sort of feminine, chauvinistic sort of terms. And when you come to Eyes Wide Shut, it's definitely Nicole's role who is the stronger one. I mean, from the very off, you know, when he's getting ready to go to the party, and the first thing she does is, you know, she tells him where his keys are and blah, blah, blah. And as they're leaving, she looks them up and down like, just like that. And it sort of told me everything, just that one gesture, you know, that she's looking at him, she's checking him out, and she's the one who thinks about things and blah, blah, blah. You know, it's... I never thought about his films as being chauvinistic at all.
Was giving a good performance in a Kubrick film a difficult thing to do in terms of the pressure and the intensity of it? Did some of them ever come in, without naming names, ever come and confide to you and say, what the fuck am I going to do?
Well, I'll start off and say very briefly, you know, there's a scene there where I talk about how he used to rehearse this. I mean, he'd kick everybody off the set, just keep the actors, and just go over it while he was trying to find his first angle. And from that first angle, everything else would flow from that. But to find that first angle was so difficult for him. It really was. The first shot was so difficult. And because he was finding it so difficult, we were running it and running it and running it and running it and running it. And gradually what happens is you drop all pretense about acting. You're getting there in a really normal, natural kind of way, and the way, you know, people don't always stand there and think through every word before they say it in life, and nor do these people, not at all. So the acting process starts to go away and erode, and you just start to be, you start to become. And then, of course, we shot a lot of takes, and so, you know, you would get pushed into that direction, which was working when Stanley thought you were ready to shoot. And I know that a lot of actors don't like the thought of doing that. I mean, they want to come in and do it straight off there. Jack was someone who could do that, but always they had long discussions. They go off for walks around the set and talk about, you know, what they were doing. And I think, you know, when you look at The Shining, and then you look at, which is of Eastwick, which he made quite soon after that, you kind of see that. I think Jack was sort of he'd kind of seized that feeling of being able to not act mad or eccentric, but to be mad and eccentric. I mean, it wasn't an acting job, not really. And I think that's one of the reasons why none of Stanley's actors ever got any kind of Oscar recognition or even nominations. Because they weren't exactly acting. They were actually being. You'd done it a million times. Mm-hmm. And you didn't remember your dialogue. You knew your dialogue. Because it was right inside your soul, your gut.
What you say, that idea of that repetition thing is so real, because you see actors who have that insecurity and that fear. And they know that time is like a hand at your throat. And you're sitting there shooting and you want to get it right. Do you think that when you talk to him, I don't want to go too far on this limb, but do you think when you talk to him and spend time with him and you are around him, could you see little moments throughout the arc of the post-Barry Lyndon career that you think he missed acting? Was he ever have doubts about giving up acting?
Yeah, we did talk a lot about that. He got his gift in Eyes Wide Shut when he got the phone call that he is Red Cloak, and a lot of people didn't know he was. Actually, that was Leon. But as he said, the phone call came in and it's like, you're doing it. And I also talked to other people that he was supposed to dub his voice because it's just impossible to get this amazing voice behind the mask. And Stanley called and said, nope, that voice is original voice. It's not dubbed. It's just as Leon done it, because Stanley just loved how he delivered it. So yeah, actually we did talk about that, and he said that actually the one time he missed acting, or the few times, was the scene on the stairs. You take it from there.
The scene on the stairs. It was shining.
Give me the bat, Wendy.
The bat, Wendy. And that's it's another example of where, you know, Stanley had taken them through the process so much, that when Jack started, it looked as if he was overplaying it a little, but the more he did it, the more he felt he could relax, and he became more terrifying for it. You know, it's quite incredible. And just a little point here, a little thing here, which, I was living with a girlfriend, and I was doing a lot of television work, and she would keep on saying, "What time are you going for practice?" And I thought, "No, darling, it's rehearsal. It's called rehearsal." Yeah. But she never stopped calling it practice. What time are you going to be back from practice? And I suddenly kind of thought, well, wait a minute, especially in television, it becomes a little bit that if you're not careful. You know, you learn the lines and you set it up. And it has to do with time as well, time and everything else. But people do arrive sometimes, this is how they're going to do it, and that's, you know, what's going to happen, and nothing can happen that'll change it or make it surprising, and it can happen on stage. It can happen anywhere, but it is that thing that, you know, a process is different to some people. Don't need it. I mean, some people don't need it. I was raised Stanislavski, for want of a better word, you know. But some people don't need it, and you don't always need it for, you know, a sitcom that lasts 30 minutes. But, you know, it's there and it sits deep, and so that, you know, ability to be able to shift and immerse yourself in that way is just wonderful. It's a wonderful thing to be able to do. That's really, it's so hard to explain, but you know what I mean.
Yeah. Talking about acting is really not the most fun thing in the world, but
I
did a sitcom for a few years, and we would do the sitcom, and we'd say our job is to get right up to the edge as close as we can to really bad acting.
Go
as far as we can. Let's take a couple of questions while we have a little bit with this juicer right here.
Did you ever think about directing yourself?
I guess I did, and I found stories that I thought, oh, I'd really like to have time, you know, to really get into this and research it and write it, and you know. So, but it's a time thing, and sometimes, I know my focus has to be 100% on what I'm doing, and I hate the thought of having to work at anything piecemeal. But as time's gone on, I suddenly realize there's a lot of time has gone by, and a project like that. So I don't know. I mean, of course, I thought about it a lot, and I think about it now.
Did Kubrick ever believe that? That living in England hurt his career, that if he lived in New York or in the States and could really go to dinners and go to meetings and pressure these people so he wouldn't be having the shitty Full Metal Jacket display at the video store and he could have things more his way. It's the squeaky wheel that gets the grease. Did he ever feel that way?
No. And we did talk about that a lot. I mean, he just said, Leon, I'm not one for going back. You know, and he liked England simply because he could push all that away from him. You know, he kept all the visits to a minimum, and he wasn't going to be having to turn up at a meeting or a meeting turn up at his place. He could more or less dictate his timetable.
Okay, over here. Right, this gentleman right here. Oh, yeah, this lady. Here we go. Sorry.
You talked in the film about the set designers having this breakdown, and I was just wondering how involved you got with the set design. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about these intensities that happened with the set designers of the film.
I can't say I was actually deeply involved in that side of it. I was there with Stanley, but the detail is so important. And with Stanley, you always felt, if there wasn't a detail there, it's because he didn't want it there, because that's how you get at this continuity thing too. You know, Stanley's there's a shot of Jack in a room typewriting, and there's a chair, and in the next shot, there isn't a chair, and that's got to mean something. And it's no, because he changed his angles, and he thought the chair fucked up his shot. You know, I mean, it was as simple as that, basic. But, you know, I think for people like Anton first, who was set, you know, production designer on Full Metal Jacket, and you know, I think all of them, very exacting, because they actually have to take material and shape it into something.
You shot it in some, like, the bombed-out ghetto of London.
Right.
Full Metal.
Yeah.
That was like some distressed...
It was a gas station, and the beautiful thing about it was that a lot of the buildings were designed by the same French architects who did a lot of work in Indochina. And so we just went around, and they grew defunct, and they were going to build a freeway through it. And so he just said, do what you like. So we went around and blew it up.
Let's take one last question right here. With the glasses. Let's do a quick question. Here we go.
Did you know his chauffeur, and what did you think of his documentary?
I knew Emilio, of course. But I haven't seen the documentary.
What does he say? That driving to work in the morning, he gave Stanley all the ideas in the car? He needed to put a 40 on there, Stanley, and got to come over the troops.
Alec, actually, everybody I shot with, they all think they were the only ones that did everything for Stanley. And they all feel or felt that they're the ones that were tortured. But literally, honestly, like from here to England to Sweden, this man was really came across constantly. He was the guy that really pretty much did everything. And sometimes it makes other people that were there furious, but he really deserves it because it is the truth.
Well, let me just say that let's have a round of applause here. On behalf of the Film Festival, this has been our 25th anniversary year. I saw this film, a link that they generously sent to me to watch this film a while back, and I fell in love with this film. I've been a great admirer of yours. I love you in that movie. I worship you in that movie. And I want to say once again, thank you both to Tony.
Thank you.
And to Leon for coming with us. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Whether or not Kubrick's approach to directing actors was more method than madness is something Leon and I could argue about. Tony Zierra's documentary, Filmworker. It's about Stanley Kubrick and Leon Vitali and everyone who sacrifices sleep and sanity to make great art, whether their names get remembered or not. I'm Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing.